I am Gautam Kumra, Chairman of McKinsey Asia, and you are listening to the Future of Asia podcast series. The Asian century has begun. The region is now the world's largest economy. As Asia's economies evolve further, the region has the potential to fuel and shape the next normal. In each episode, we are going to feature conversations with leaders from across the region to discuss what Asia's rise means for businesses across the globe. Join us.
Welcome to a new episode of the Future of Asia podcast. My name is Angela and I'll be your host for today. In this episode, we'll be looking into Japanese corporations and the potential they have to play a critically important role in the advancement of the country and society. I'm joined by Nayuki Iwatani, managing partner of McKinsey's offices in Japan, and Mikola Ravisioni, a senior partner based in McKinsey's Tokyo office. Both are co-authors of a newly released book, Unlocking the Full Potential of Japanese Corporates, which will be the topic for today's discussion. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So, to kick us off, perhaps you could both share a little more about the book. What was the inspiration behind it and what does it address?
So to me, I think first and foremost, we do believe the huge potential of Japanese corporates. Particularly, we see multiple underlying strengths that we can describe a bit more. But ultimately, those are the ones that we think the companies should more leverage and make the best of. If they do so, there should be a very good opportunities going forward. But at the same time, we also recognize the challenges to overcome. So therefore, we really wanted to show our commitments, excitements for Japanese corporates, especially the global ones, in writing our thoughts and also sharing those to as many companies as possible.
We decided to write this book because by working with Japanese organizations with global aspirations for many years, we have learned to appreciate the strengths and almost the hidden treasure in these organizations. There are many preconceptions and sometimes prejudices on these organizations, and sometimes the potential within them is neglected. In addition, we see almost an imperative for Japanese organizations to increase their performance. The inflow of capital, the geopolitical environment are all very favorable to those Japanese companies that can take advantage of it. But we have many investors and business leaders wondering whether it is possible to transform and accelerate the performance of Japanese organizations. And we think we have learned something about it over the last decade and more of working with them. And so we thought we would share some of these learnings with those that are interested out there.
Thank you for that description. Mikola, you spoke about the strengths of Japanese corporations and the immense potential that they have. Maybe you can share a little more on those strengths and also about what gives you the confidence that they can become major players in the global market.
There are some strengths that I think are well known, even to foreign observers, like probably the listeners to this podcast. Some of this is the strength of the craftsmanship or monozukuri, the ability to create products at a very high quality using manufacturing skills that are more complex than just assembly, and as such are very difficult to replicate and to outcompete. I think the customer orientation of Japanese organizations, particularly in the services businesses, also well known and appreciated, the concept of omotenashi, the almost obsessive customer focus. And this is something that many companies around the world are trying to achieve. Anyone is obsessed with making their organization customer-centric. And many Japanese organizations are culturally very attuned to their customers. And the power of the Japan brand, it is very well known and identified with quality and increasingly in fashion. Just a silly anecdote, but just a few weeks ago, the Somerset House in London opened a very interesting exposition on the culture of cute and kawaii, which is another big contribution that Japan had on in fashion and the arts. All of this can be leveraged. There are also other strengths that sometimes are not well understood and are an opportunity, an untapped opportunity for Japanese organizations. For example, Japanese organizations are often criticized for lifetime employment and loyalty. And this is described as a hurdle, as a drag to performance. We would argue that this is an incredible opportunity to invest in the long-term upskilling and reskilling of employees. Employees will stay and organizations will be rewarded with the return on their investment of their employees. Very different from, for example, the Anglo-Saxon model where job hopping is much more common. There is this notion of the generalist management model in Japan, where leaders rotate around the organization in different roles. And this is true, and this is often a drag to performance. But if we think about future operating models, such as, for example, agile organizations, which is based on the dynamic and frequent reallocation of resources, that is a strength because Japanese employees are used to being told to move and change on a fairly short notice and pretty quickly. So there are some well-known strengths, but there are also some hidden opportunities that smart leaders in Japanese organizations are started to harness.
Thank you. Now, is there anything you wanted to add to Mikola's response?
I think the 2-3 small additions from my side to Mikola's point is, A, I think still the country and Japanese corporations have a very good innovations for Japan and the rest of the world. I think the anime and soft power, as Mikola said, is one of those. But also from a technology point of view, Japan has been known as a country of many advanced technologies. Actually, in the recent survey, I think that was more from a 2023, like a top 100 global innovator or innovation. I think 38 companies are from Japan, which was 35 in the previous year. And that was clearly the number one among the countries which produce such a high innovative companies or innovative technologies. And that's a one just example, but whenever it comes to the perfection, whenever it comes to creating something new and really sharpening the value proposition to the very excellence level is something that I think Japanese corporates and culture has it. And also, one more thing is, which is more on the mindsets and culture side, but I think the resilience is something that I think many of the Japanese corporations have as their underlying strengths. Whenever the disasters hit, whenever uncertain things happen in the history of Japan, always there was a recovery in a successful but very resilient way, in a harmonious way, and also collaborative way. So these are the soft elements from a cultural and mindset perspective. Something that in this world, in the current context, can be deployed and can be played on in terms of strengths, from my perspective.
Thank you for sharing that. Both of you mentioned these traits in Japanese corporations that many could describe as being unique to companies in Japan. Based on these unique endowments, what makes you think that Japanese firms are potentially better suited to contribute to sustainable and inclusive growth, not only in Japan, but also perhaps on a global level?
First of all, I think in my observation, I think many of the Japanese corporations, as Mikel and I shared, have a great potential. However, in many cases, the aspiration in the first place is not high enough or aspirational enough. I think we do survey as McKinsey in terms of high growth companies versus not, what makes a difference in terms of leadership attributes and then organizational attributes. I think the five mindsets along with the growth, I think around a very clear story why we want to grow in a very beneficial way for the customers and stakeholders in society, and also agile way of trying the new things to get to the growth. And also something learned out of the failure is another thing which is very important. And also personalizing and also understanding either B2B customers or B2C customers as a very granular level. And then lastly, not least, not just short-term, but also long-term perspective. So these are the five elements that we see as McKinsey. And then actually, when we did an interview and survey across countries and companies, Japanese corporations are lower in these aspects. On the other side, if the company has at least the 3 out of 5, they can grow by 2.5 times or almost triple. So there's a clear indication that how the company aims the next level and how they act in a very consistent manner as a growth-oriented mindset company, that's something that Japanese corporation can do a better job.
If I think about social inclusion and contribution of Japanese companies, there are a couple of traits that come to mind. One is that Japanese companies tend to be long-term oriented and tend to be fairly patient with performance management and return their investments. Now, this is a very favorable substrate to allow the workforce, particularly I'm thinking about diverse workforce, women in the workforce, more flexibility in their working arrangement, more flexibility of role, again, with this long-term orientation. And Japanese companies tend to take social responsibility much more seriously. What I mean is the social responsibility to, for example, sustain employment, to sustain an ecosystem of suppliers, to support customers, is deeply embedded, sometimes to a fault, in these organizations. And this, again, presents a very solid starting point to create a socially engaged and responsible organization on the challenges of the future. Lastly, the technological capabilities of Japan Inc. are incredibly powerful in tackling some of the planetary challenges. If you think about energy transition, for example, if you think about environmental sustainability, because Japan is a unique industrial ecosystem to make those large capital investments and deploy some of the large engineering projects. So when I think about societal inclusion, when I think about diversity of the workforce, and when I think about the environmental challenges, I think Japanese companies can and should play a very important role.
There was something that I think both of you have mentioned in some of your responses, which is the soft power that Japanese corporations wield culturally all over the globe. So maybe for our listeners who aren't too familiar with kawaii culture anime, for example, maybe you can elaborate a little bit more on what you mean by soft power being one of the strengths of Japanese corporations.
I think the soft power, first of all, defined as including as multidimensional things. So we could say as a brand, it's a values. We could say it's a style. We could say it's culture. So it's quite a multidimensional and very broad definition. I think what Michele and I said in terms of soft power of Japan is something along the line of, first of all, very interesting creative things studied in Japan, like anime is one thing, but over time, I think the different types of innovations here and there, including small things like food and some entertainment, and it could be anything. But I think that's one type of assets that Japanese corporations have and Japan as a country has. The other one is the mindsets, which Michele also mentioned around the passion, commitment to the social responsibilities, and people act for the good purpose of the corporations, but also the society, quite a many consistent way. And also people in general, I think collaborative and also open to have a big changes whenever needed. It's a bit slow to see and act on the other side, but these are the type of things that we are mentioning. But at the same time, I think this needs to be also deployed and also sometimes much more reinforced. For example, in this global company setup, diversity and inclusion is so instrumental in terms of next generation of growth and also innovation, more values to the society, and also obviously each other among the employees for their growth and excitement. I think the Japanese corporations on that dimension is quite behind, because usually people have a common implicit sort of understanding and nuance, which is probably true and then working in Japan only in the country. But it's not true whenever the corporations act at the global scale with a diverse talent. So there's a both ends of, first of all, soft power can be deployed. But the other side, I think there needs to be advancements in this real diversity and inclusion embracement at the global scale.
There's two elements in the Japan soft power. A lot could be discussed, and that's probably not the main purpose of this dialogue. But clearly, anything that is made in Japan comes with a very positive connotation and brand equity. Anything that is, Japan is interesting, it's curious to everyone. Japan has a reputation of innovation rooted in tradition, so a reliable innovation. And Japan has a reputation of quality and execution. So there is a perception of quality even before a customer experiences a product. Those are incredibly good and strong starting points. However, Japanese companies need to really do two things. One is to nurture that favorable brand. I think we read, unfortunately, over the last year or two, many quality issues with Japanese products that are starting to make a dent in the reputation of Japanese companies as excellent in quality execution. So going from an informal and almost inherited orientation to quality to something that is nurtured and made a specific purpose of the organization is very important with the skills that this requires. And then this brand must be codified and used purposefully. Again, this brand is inherited and is the result of decades of history and experience with Japan. But what does it mean? What are the attributes of being a Japanese brand, and how are they relevant to different products and product categories? So to some degree, this is basic marketing work that organizations, and some are starting to do, to translate Japan brand attributes into company and product brand attributes and amplify the value of the former to the benefit of the commercial success of Japanese products overseas.
The two of you have spoken about Japanese culture being a great starting point to elevate their presence globally. You mentioned that there were a few stereotypes that people may have had about Japanese corporations. I wanted to ask if there was anything in particular that you wanted to address in terms of those stereotypes, and maybe where people might be thinking about how Japanese corporates work incorrectly.
I don't know if this answers the question directly, Angela, but one mistake that often, particularly overseas investors, make is to think that the deployment of capital is sufficient to trigger actions at the management level. And this is particularly visible today. There's a significant amount of capital that is coming into Japan for many reasons beyond the purpose of this podcast. And the valuation of many companies is growing as a result. And the assumption that many foreign investors make is that the deployment of capital will naturally create the right pressure on boards of directors and create the right incentives for CEOs and executive committees to then drive a performance agenda. That unfortunately doesn't work in Japan in a similar way as it would work in the United States and in Europe or in most other places. So one mistake that foreign investors make when looking at the Japanese companies is to just stop there, stop at the deployment of capital. Successful investors actually lean in on Japanese companies in a collaborative way to chart a path, to show a path to performance enhancement so that executive committees and CEOs can act on that path. So investors are encouraged, and our experience is that investors can do a better job at declaring what they expect their capital deployment, their investment would trigger at a company level to help boards and executive committees translate the deployment of capital into an action plan. That's one part of the answer. Among these stereotypes, I pick up again on some of the ones I mentioned earlier. This idea of a consensus culture is very true, and it can slow down decision making, but it also favors and supports cross-functional decision making and risk assessment. And in this environment, both are very important features, and it keeps companies from making mistakes that are later regrettable. The notion of lifetime employment and loyalty is often seen as a drag. It is actually an opportunity to invest in employees upskilling and reskilling with an expectation of getting the return on such investment. And Japanese companies still invest way less than foreign companies on professional development of their employees. This notion of the generalist management model is at times frustrating, but it can be an asset in organizations that pivot to an agile operating model because of employees' comfort with moving and being redeployed to teams on a fairly regular basis. One key shift that Japanese organizations need to make, and the successful ones are making, is to harness all of these strengths and shift from an informal to a formal organization. Japanese organizations are informal. They are informal in the definition of roles and responsibilities for their leaders and employees. They're informal in the definition of basic processes and the definition of the way organizations work. This requires learning how the organization works through apprenticeship, which has benefits in skill transfer, but it's also very slow and difficult, particularly for the integration of new members of the organization. And so the ability to harness these qualities that reside in Japanese companies, whether it is cultural elements, whether it is technical skills related to manufacturing, technical skills related to innovation and new product development, customer orientation in their services department, codify those and define what is it that we do well and how do we scale it is quite important. There are organizations that are successfully exporting, for example, manufacturing skills, monozukuri culture. They're distilling, what does it mean to do great manufacturing? What is it that we do well? And then transfer it to overseas operations in the United States, in Europe, with great success. But that requires a discipline, the development of a language, the development of a set of tools, which are then deployed to train employees. And that's not typically the way Japanese organizations work. So that's an important unlock that, when deployed, we have seen to be very, very successful, and to, as a result, also create a much more enjoyable working environment for the employees that feel they have a better understanding of where they belong in a formal versus informal organization. It reduces the risk of some of the less inclusive behaviors that are made possible today by the organization being so informal and hierarchical and patriarchal at times. And they also facilitate significantly the integration of new employees from other organizations that get plugged in into a somewhat structured working environment, as opposed to having to really work through the motion of learning from experience how the organization works.
Thank you for sharing that, Mikola. Maybe the two of you can share a little bit more about the key unlocks that would be needed in order for Japanese corporations to be taken to the next level.
I think for Japanese corporations to get to the next level, especially being much more credible and competitive in the global markets, there are multiple areas that we see as a common areas to be addressed as unlock. One area is the business portfolio. Actually, Japanese corporations are known as a very longevity organizations for many years. They've been working with the same sort of a business domain for many years, even the same business model. Sometimes, on the other side, given the attachment, given the commitments, it is very difficult, and then this is very emotional decision in terms of changing the business portfolio, which sometimes becomes a bit of a big hurdles for big corporations to update portfolio. But this is one of the areas where the circumstances changing, new technologies are coming in. So I think dynamically, many of the Japanese global corporations should look into it, and then what's the strengths, what's the future, therefore what could be the best way for them to update its business portfolio. So that's one area. The other area is the whole point of a digital, but more context of how to deploy the data in the current context. I think a lot of things already happening in the form of a POC, let's try this and that. So I think the Japanese corporations in general are getting much more familiarized with the leveraging data for business value creation. I think nevertheless, from a talent perspective and top management teams' understanding and commitments on deploying the technologies, I think the reskilling, upskilling throughout the organization for this one is also continued to be very important, including some ideas around capability-based acquisition. Lastly, not least, also Michele shared, Japanese corporations, unfortunately, on average, compared to those in other geographies, have been under-investing people in terms of the amount of money, amount of hours they put for their employees to be reskilled. So therefore, I think that's one thing that, along with the mindset change, especially the diversity inclusion in the global context, is something that Japanese corporation has as a very important unlock, in my view.
A lot is written already about reform of corporate governance, board of directors, capital allocation policies, and all of this. I would like to take the lens of what are some of the behaviors that could make a difference on a day-to-day basis. And a few come to mind. For investors, do more than just deploy capital, but to take the time to develop a thesis and communicate the thesis and the actions that would be expected to management can be powerful. A typical mistake of foreign investors in particular is to assume that the deployment of capital can be translated to an action plan to create return by management. For boards of directors is really to shift from nominating a CEO as a recognition of past achievements and loyalty to nominate a CEO for the future mission. Nominate a CEO for what a board expects a CEO to do, and not as a recognition of his status as a representative of the company. For CEOs, the list is probably longer, but one is shifting the narrative from humble and protective to confident and engaging. Many organizations that are making a shift in performance are a little bit more self-confident and self-aware of what they do well, but they're more humble and open when it comes to integrating ideas from outside, integrating employees and capabilities from the outside. Another behavioral suggestion to CEOs, or what good CEOs and high-performing CEOs do well in Japan, is really to lead from the front. It's as simple as the CEO leading the executive committee meeting, as opposed to having the office of the CEO run the executive committee as a bureaucracy. And I know this may sound very tactical, but this is something that happens many times a week and has a significant implication for the performance of the organization. I think I referred to earlier at harnessing the strength of the organization and shifting from an informal to a formal organization. So these strengths are not as strengths that have been inherited from the past, but strengths that are well understood, codified, and can then be trained at scale to employees on a global basis. And we talked about manufacturing, branding, product development, and maybe thinking about workforce planning strategically. In the next 10 to 15 years, but we see it already on an annual scale now, the skill set required to compete will be tremendously different. And all the digital and analytical tools or skills are referred to as an example, but it's not only those. And those skills are not always available in Japan. The school system doesn't always create engineers and technicians with those skills. And so Japanese companies, more than others, need to get ahead in having a vision for what skill set will be required 5-10 years out. Where is that skill set available? And how to increase the availability of that talent that is so necessary? The recruitment out of school and advancement through age has been a drag for years, but will be even more a drag given the pace at which innovation is happening. Japanese organizations have the great opportunity and perhaps even the imperative to accelerate a generational transition. The new generation of leaders in Japan has grown up in a very different era than the generation of current leaders and has a different skill set. Japanese universities and schools are of very, very high quality, and they form very talented and skilled individuals. And they have a different mindset when it comes to entitlement and desire to improve their position. But there's a time dimension to this. Their motivation, their energy may run out. So what high-performing Japanese organizations do, they find a way to create roles, create opportunities, skip layers, and empower the next generation to make a difference within their organizations and remove some of the hierarchical obstacles that exist.
Now, did you want to share any more on the lessons that CEOs and corporate leaders in Japan can take away from this book?
Maybe simply speaking, I think 2-3 points that I think would be wonderful for readers to take away as a lessons or learning reflection for leaders. One thing is, as I mentioned earlier, I think having and setting a very high aspiration for the organization and for the employees and also any other stakeholders in the value chain. I think unless there's a high aspiration with the confidence, but also humbleness to keep changing, nothing great happens. So I think that's one first dimension. The other thing is, I think, role modeling. I think in many ways, the world will be changing constantly. Technologies, innovations, many, many things will come in a very rapid way. I think the leaders can only learn by talking to customers and also other external people and also internally employees, not just with the top team colleagues, but also across all the levels and departments and groups in the organization. So I think the role modeling to do the right things in front of as many eyes as possible is something that very important. So therefore, even I think one of the key roles for CEOs and CXOs is, and also any managers and someone who leads others, is kind of a chief inspiration officer, sort of a mindset. It's something that I think is going to be very important going forward. And then lastly, not least, I think I'll be positive and keep trying. I think in the history of Japan, in the history of last 3 decades or so for Japanese corporations, it's been a time where the Japanese corporations in general lost a bit of a confidence. and also optimism about the future. Changing circumstance is obviously sometimes a bit scary, but at the same time, it is a chance for Japanese corporations to get all the followings and also capitalize and also unlock the full potential. So this, I think, even more than ever, optimism and also forward-looking and positive mindset is very important. So these are 3 points from my side.
One overarching message that we're trying to deliver, and the reason why we decided to write the book, is to inspire confidence that there is enough experience and there are enough learnings over the last 7-8 years to be able to have confidence in transforming Japanese organizations. It is not a craft left to a few individuals, but there is a discipline that can be deployed and that has worked in Japan, in many Japanese companies across industries, to start and deliver the value of a transformation in a way that is very in tune with the reality of Japanese organizations. So we want to encourage investors, members of boards of directors and CEOs to have the confidence that a methodology exists and that a lot of lessons can be drawn from companies that have done this successfully in a way that is very suitable and proven to work in Japan. The second takeaway is also that executives are now, there is a class of executives in Japan that have gone through this journey and that are reaching critical mass and that can really start to make a difference at scale across multiple organizations. So the capability to innovate and transform Japanese companies can now be deployed at scale at the system level just because enough emerging leaders have experienced the journey and can now take more senior leadership roles to continue to drive it across multiple companies.
Thank you, Naon Mikula, for sharing your insights on the Future of Asia podcast. For those of you interested, the Japanese language version of the Unlocking the Potential of Japanese Corporates book is available on Amazon.
You have been listening to the Future of Asia podcast by McKinsey & Company. To learn more about McKinsey, our people, our latest thinking, visit us at mckinsey.com/futureofasia or find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook.